Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or JeffWeilerColumbusAutoMall.com.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, everybody. We've got a great conversation coming up today on the Michael Steele podcast with the 2024 campaign quickly approaching. The political players are beginning to line themselves up who are trying to vie for the executive office. Who are these individuals? They're complicated people? Really not so much, but okay, we'll go with that. But how will they change the face of politics in this next race? And what does that say about our politics right now? My guest today, as we get into that and the war in Ukraine and the leadership of both Biden and Zelensky that was on display this past week, is Charlie Sykes, founder and editor at large of The Bulwark, host of The Bulwark podcast, and an MSNBC political contributor. So happy to have Charlie come on and help us break it all down. Coming up next on the Michael Steele podcast. Again, welcome everybody to the Michael Steele podcast. I am delighted to have my buddy, Charlie Sykes from The Bulwark, to come on and sort of help us do a moment in time assessment over the last couple of weeks, where we've had developments in the presidential campaign. We've had developments in the effort to prosecute the war in Ukraine. We've had developments with just the mindless stupidity of the GOP. And who better than my man, Charlie Sykes, to come on and have this conversation. Welcome, my friend.
This is going to be like a 6-hour podcast.
Just the
mindless stupidity of the GOP. I mean, that seems like a volume in and of itself.
Look, I've already got a drink here at my desk, so we're ready. I started this thing like, you know, gin and tonic at 10 a.m. And there are those days when I, you know, would do these early shows like Morning Joe, and by 10 o'clock, I'm like so completely wiped out. I'm like, I got to have a drink.
Michael, this is how I got through the pandemic, honestly, seriously. I don't know how people survive this without the day drinking.
I swear, you know,
between you and me,
it's all good. It's all good. So, you know, there are a number of places to start this conversation, and we'll save the fun stuff for near the end, because by that point we may need to have a good laugh. But I do want to start with the effort right now in Ukraine. Here we are at the 1-year anniversary. I even hate putting it that way, because this is such a mindless and useless loss of life perpetrated by a thug in Vladimir Putin. But how are you assessing, particularly given Biden's incredible journey to Kyiv, and spending that time, that visual of him and president together with Zelensky? It was such a moment on so many levels, and I'm sure it irked the hell out of Putin and the Kremlin.
Yes, on every single kind. It was impressive. It was impressive not just as a political move, but as a quintessentially American move. You know, as you think about the way this war has played out and all the unexpected ways that it has played out, I continue to be struck by the moral clarity That what you're seeing is you're seeing these courageous men and women of Ukraine fighting against this genocidal, invasion. You have, somebody, the Churchillian figure of our time, Volodymyr Zelensky, up against Vladimir Putin, who is just a two-bit gangster who has been exposed. And it's very difficult to understand how there are people in American politics who look at that same situation and do not see the clarity, who do not understand the global significance of it, the geopolitical mm-hmm. significance, America's direct political, military interest in all of this. But to your question about Joe Biden, this was one of the greatest moments of his presidency. And as you know, I am not a Joe Biden fanboy. I have been skeptical about his use of the bully pulpit. I don't think he's used it as effectively. I don't think that he's made the case as strongly as he can. I think he's been too tentative and slow on occasions. However, this was an extraordinary moment that, again, underlined the moral clarity, underlined our absolute commitment to this cause. And I did you hear his speech in Poland the next day?
Yes.
Sure you did, man.
Yes.
You and I are both old enough to remember.
Yes.
When every Republican in America would have got a tingle up their leg if they would have heard those words from Ronald Reagan, mm-hmm. George H.W. Bush, mm-hmm. George W. Bush, or somebody like John McCain. These were the kinds of speeches that Republicans used to recognize as this is what America is about. Right. And so, boy, how the world has been turned. Yeah, turned on its head.
It encapsulated the American mission. Yeah. It affirmed the American partnership with our allies, and specifically our standing with not just what's going on right now in Ukraine, but with Poland and a lot of those countries that feel, if y'all don't like firm up this wall, we're going to get steamrolled by this thing. And it was interesting. You wrote a great piece that came out this week that I recommend to folks on the Bulwark as part of the Morning Shots, in which, this trip by Biden was not a stunt, but rather, as you said, an act of statesmanship. You go on to note, even National Review acknowledged that, quote, Biden's secret trip to Kyiv took guts, declaring that his visit to wartime Kyiv is an example of America in its finest tradition. That from National mm-hmm. Review, which when that headline hit, I just kind of actually was gobsmacked. I was like, mm-hmm. excuse me, what? But then you go on and you call out the useful idiots, because we did hear from the useful idiots, the Marjorie Taylor Greene's, the Matt Gaetz is in his performative BS. You note, quote, there are no MAGA pacifists or anti-war doves. A few are genuinely America first isolationists. A few are pro-Putin because they have a kink for authoritarian strongmen with a penchant for lying and brutality. And a lot of them are anti-Zelensky because, and this is the kicker, because they are pro-Trump. They are all anti-Biden. That's the narrative around the party that you and I, grew up in politically and advocated on behalf of, particularly at global moments like this, as you noted, when you had a Reagan or a Bush 41 or 43 standing on that global stage, affirming solidarity with our allies. We have these useful idiots here at home plying in the trade of bullshit lies and obfuscation and making a lot of noise that basically plays into Putin's hands, even though it doesn't resonate, it just gums up the works, you know?
Yeah, I understand the dynamic here, that when you think about it, that if Donald Trump's presidency was defined by his relationship with Vladimir Putin, Joe Biden's is really defined by his relationship now with Zelensky. And you cannot, if you are the Matt Gaetz's, the Marjorie Taylor Greens, or any of the MAGA types, sit back and look at Vladimir Zelensky and see, this is a symbol of the free world, without also remembering that he was also the guy who was shaken down by Donald Trump, who was central right. to Donald Trump's first impeachment. So they are carrying that on their shoulders. And so, you know, I was thinking about the other day, there have been some Republicans who have been pretty staunch on this, you know, including, bear with me here, Lindsey Graham, you know, has been, you know, pretty tough in his support for Ukraine. But at some point, the question is, would Lindsey Graham be capable, would he be willing and capable of betraying Ukraine in order to keep in Donald Trump's good graces? For a lot of Republicans, that's the choice. Are they willing to stand for freedom? Are they willing to stand for Ukraine? Or is their loyalty to Donald Trump the be-all and the end-all? And at some point, I think they're trying to finesse all these things. They're trying to pretend that they can have both of these things. But at some point, there's going to be a time for choosing.
How do you see this? You touched on it in your initial thoughts, but how do you see this playing out for the Biden administration, particularly as we begin the setup for a 2024 presidential campaign? What narratives? I mean, I think there are a lot of really strong narratives that are in the you know quiver for the Biden team, both domestically and internationally, but they've been woeful at articulating them over the last 24 months. Going into the next 18 months, how do you see this particular piece playing out for the Biden folks and the president specifically?
Well, I think objectively, Joe Biden's future is tied inextricably to Ukraine's. You know, for better or for worse. Look, I think this is a bright red line. I think that this is, you know, one of those issues that will define 2024, how you stand on all of that. If, in fact, Ukraine continues to win this war, it's going to be a tremendous plus as a leader of the world. But you and I both know that there's always that danger of Americans becoming fatigued with the cost and the expense of all of this. What the Biden administration has to understand is for them, both geopolitically and politically, there's no alternative to Ukraine winning. Ukraine has to win this thing because defeat is disastrous. But I actually do, going back to a more of a political answer, over the last couple of weeks, you know, Joe Biden, between the very effective State of the Union address, which completely surprised me, and this visit to Kyiv, this feels as if he's finding his voice. This almost feels as if now he's growing into his presidency. Doesn't change the fact that he's 80, doesn't change any of the other political dynamics in the world. But he feels like he has a little bit more momentum than I would have said 3, 4, 5, 6 months from now. But as you and I both know, Michael, things change so quickly in politics. And the bit, you know, there's a lot of big question marks over 2024, including what's the economy going to look like? What is going to happen with inflation? What will those interest rates do to the economy and to jobs? You know, what can possibly go wrong in Ukraine that, in fact, would turn that from a net asset into a liability? We just don't know those things. But Joe Biden, at least for the moment, seems to have hit a stride.
What's your take of the critiques of the right, of the president in this space? And we can get into the domestic stuff, which is a whole different can of crazy. But my sense is, Charlie, the footing is so weak here, yet they persist.
Yes.
I mean, when you're anchoring yourself to the likes of Putin and other authoritarian figures from, you know, Italy onward, how do you even position yourself rhetorically against the president? Who are you trying to appeal to? I mean, because yeah. most people look at you going, well, we kind of support Ukraine, number one, and number two, yeah, this is a good thing. We don't get it. I don't get why they don't get it. Are they so deep that they can't get out? Or what's your assessment there?
Yeah, Well, I mean, they're so deep in anti-Bidenism that there's nothing that he can do that they won't object to. So, I mean, there is that. On the other hand, this is a cautionary note. There's a long tradition of isolationism in American politics. I mean, America True. First was not invented by Donald Trump. It was a big thing in the 30s. And also, I think we ought to recognize that Americans have short attention spans. And so to a certain extent, if you keep hammering on something long enough, you might have some traction. But let's leave the horse race out of it for a moment. Just in terms of, and I think sometimes we all get caught up in being being pundits here, but to step back and go, look, you know, this is America at its best. If there is a fight for democracy, it is taking place right now. You are watching brave men and women fighting for their freedom, looking to us for support. You are seeing this, the revival of the evil empire, you know, killing, indiscriminately murdering men, women, and children. We should be able to take a side here. We should be able to recognize who we are as Americans. And I also have to say that this growing sort of fascination with the fascists and the neo-fascists of Europe, the Orbans, et cetera, the authoritarians, the growing fascination with them by American conservatives who used to follow, say, Ronald Reagan, mm-hmm. is bizarre. It's a weird turn. It's a weird, and it's a weird, ugly, dangerous turn that they look to these guys, some of the worst people in the world, some of the worst thuggish monsters in the world, and they think, I have more in common with them than I have with my neighbor in the next blue state. There's something deeply wrong with that.
It is. And it really kind of speaks to a lot of the core of the domestic political upheaval that we've experienced since about 2015. And actually, in many respects, Charlie, as you and I know, it goes back. I mean, Trump was able to sort of, you know, not only just gash open the wound further, but actually pour a whole lot of infectious stuff into it that makes it makes it that much more painful. But there is this sort of, you're right, you know, there's always been this strain of sort of, you know, isolationism of in American culture and politics. You know, Roosevelt had to deal with it in the 1930s leading up to World War II. You certainly saw it rear its head again in the late stages of the Korean War, leading into, of course, the Vietnam War. So we know historically, but the difference, though, is that Americans have largely sort of rallied to the cause. And that's been because of, as you, I think, aptly described of Joe Biden, the kind of leadership that states the clarity of the moment and gives Americans at least an appreciation of why this mission is important. And arguably the other party out of power was respectful of that. You know, the old rubric of, okay, president's on foreign soil, we won't criticize him while he's on foreign soil. You know, we will stand united in that regard. All that's gone out the window now. And it really is a matter of doing the gotcha without really substantively putting on the table by Republicans in this case. So you don't support Zelensky and Ukraine. What the hell do you think happens when you pull back those resources and Putin rolls over Ukraine? And then B, what accountability are you prepared to commit to when he decides Belarus, Poland, or any other Eastern European country is for the taking? What's your plan? and the Republicans seem to be pretty short on answering that question, whether internationally or domestically, when it comes to what's your plan.
No, because I mean they think in 5-minute increments, right? I mean this is the goldfish party. You know, on the other hand, and I think I we probably ought to just, you know, just make the point here. that right now there is a strong bipartisan, there is strong bipartisan support for what Joe Biden is doing. And I suppose that's the good news. I mean, the, you know, the right. bad news is that you have the demagogues out there. The bad news, I think, is that even people like Ron DeSantis have decided that they're going to go in that direction as well. I think that's where the id of the Republican Party is. But, at, you know, as of this moment, there's a strong majority in both houses of Congress to continue to support that. The American people still support it. The question is, you know, where is this going to go? Joe Biden is on the right side of this. And by the way, what really struck me this week was, you know, you and I have watched Joe Biden for a long time. Yeah. Joe Biden was not always this guy. Let's be honest about it. Joe Biden has grown. He has learned. He has been willing to change his position. Joe Biden, a year ago today, could not have envisioned where we are right now.
No, so I agree.
He still has the flexibility to say, okay, I thought this was going to be my policy and approach. I'm going to adjust it. And I think that, you know, by going to Kyiv, what you saw was his saying, I'm going to be all in on this. So he has a plan. He has a vision. He has an emerging foreign policy that I think is something that people can get behind, you know. And I suppose, you know, one of the things that's really gratifying is watching that the vast majority of Democrats are really supportive of this. There doesn't seem to be a lot of division, and that you have the most responsible Republicans who are still in charge of this, because despite all of our partisan and tribal differences, there is that core memory of what it means to be an American at its best.
Yeah.
And that goes back to where we started. That's why that speech was so powerful, kind of reminding people that, okay, this was an American speech. This is the quintessential American presidential speech. And so with all the dust and all the bullshit that's, you know, around, it's we're at a moment where at least most Americans are still able to recognize that. And that's good news.
That is good news. And with that, we're going to take a quick pause because when we come back, I want to get into the hot, sexy stuff. the stuff that you and I dig into every day, baby. That is the domestic political scene here at home. We're having great conversation with my man, Charlie Sykes from The Bulwark. We'll be right back with more Charlie right after this.
All right, America, you asked for it. Or maybe you didn't. But either way, we have to talk. You're just in kind of a crazy place right now, Mr. and Mrs. USA. So we're going to sit down a couple of times a week and work it out between us. The way Americans do. On a podcast. Hosted by Beowulf Rocklin. Weird name. Weird news. Weird politics. Weird country. Facepalm America. Available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen.
Welcome back, everybody, to Michael Steele Podcast. So, Charlie, where to begin? So let's start at the beginning. I guess we could do that. You tweeted in 2021 that Succession is the next big MAGA play.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, as if on stupid cue, you had Marjorie Taylor Greene and a few others out there actually actively talking about Succession this past week, that we should, the red states and the blue states just need to separate. We need a divorce. We need a divorce, Charlie. And if you're in a blue state and you want to come to a red state, well, guess what we're going to do? We are going to not allow you to vote for 5 years just to prove you're with us. Okay, so on a bullshit meter, that's off the scale.
Off
stupid.
The scales. Yeah.
Off the scale stupid. But you understood something about what you were seeing then in 2021 that now 2 years later is being, or at least attempted rhetorically, to be actualized by the idiot class inside the GOP?
Well, and I'm sorry to be right about this. I really am. This was shortly after the attack on January 6th. And I thought that it was going to be a small step from sedition to secession. And it felt inevitable, in part because, as we've seen, we have these crazy ideas at the far edges of the fever swamp, and they sort of fester there. But they're moving with incredible velocity toward the mainstream. And part of what we're having here now is this division of America into us versus them. Mm-hmm. And how much of the politics of people like Marjorie Taylor Greene is to say that the real enemies, your real enemies are not in Moscow. The real enemies are not abroad. The real enemy is your fellow American. It is that American who lives in that blue state or that red state, and right. that we have irreconcilable differences. And so the idea of dividing the country up into us versus them is also feels inevitable, especially and because you've lived through this, that you're living in an environment where they have to constantly keep upping the quality of the crack they're selling.
Right.
I mean, it's like a crack dealer. Right. And it's like, We got away with making a good living selling the heroin, and then we were selling the crack. And then you know what? Somebody else is going to come along, and we better have the purest crystal meth on the street. And the purest crystal meth this week is we have to break because everybody's talking about it. Now, obviously, if you listen to Marjorie Taylor Greene, you can tell one thing is, first of all, that she's given actually no serious thought to this whatsoever, right?
Of course not.
I mean, the whole idea of like, we will not allow you to vote for 5 years. If you are a Democrat moving from a, okay, so
the hell would a Democrat move to a red state for under those circumstances in the first place?
Well, also, I mean, so she's from Georgia. Is Georgia a red state or a blue state?
I'm just blue.
I'm just not sure. Does she have to leave? Is she allowed to vote in the next state that she shows up in? What papers do you have to show to give your credentials of who to vote? And would you ever be permitted to vote against the red state oligarchy? Because she seems to think that if you move into a red state, that they are entitled to keep power no matter what. So, and again, we just can't even break into it. But the fact that, you know, we are living in this age where tens of millions of people believe conspiracy theories, where they do believe that other Americans are their enemies, which they do are encouraged to feel completely alienated from the not real part of America. It does feel as if there's a crack up coming, a breakup coming. It's not going to be a national divorce, you know, state by state. Because, I mean, maybe it'll be county by county. I don't know. But it's part of it's comedic and part of it is dangerous.
Because I don't know how these idiots think this ends well for them. I mean, the one thing about authoritarianism is that eventually it turns on the very people who helped set it up. I mean, you think you've got an inside straight. But as we've already seen with the likes of Donald Trump, that is a very fleeting relationship. It is not something that guarantees you a pole position in his orbit or any of their orbits longer term. But it does, I think, to your point, speak to just the general breakdown of a once proud political party that has now become nothing more than a corporate grifting entity that promotes this kind of, you know, crap. I mean, so for example, you have also this week, the Speaker of the House, and I really wanted to talk to you about this as a journalist, let alone as a political guy. The Speaker of the House gave Fox News's Tucker Carlson exclusive access to 44,000, you know,
hours
of January 6th exclusively.
Yeah.
Not to, okay, here's a reporter at CNN or someone over there, just to him. So I, in my response to him, I tweeted out, what else did you promise to give away, Kevin? What price will the country pay for your ambition, Speaker McCarthy? You mean to tell me Marjorie Taylor Greene wasn't enough? I mean, where are we going now that this is how this is playing out, where the national security implications of that footage is not lost on anyone? And certainly from some of the Republicans I've heard are sitting there going, what the hell is this man doing? How do you see this? I mean, what do you think the end game was here? Because I look at it, this is something was one of those secret promises that was made in order to secure
and that's what he said. And that's what he told the New York Times. Well, I promised I was going to do this awful, terrible thing. Look, this looks really bad. I think it's actually worse than that. And I think that even though there's always the temptation to get numbed by the awfulness of Kevin McCarthy, this is shocking that he would do this, that he would go this far. And of course, another indication of his fear and his attempt to appease the alligator that he's been growing in his bathtub and hoping will not get out and eat him, eat his face. but I agree with you. I think there are national security implications and these tapes should not have been released. But if they are going to be released, as I said the other day on one of the cable shows, then they have to be released to everybody. Then the lawyers for CBS, ABC, NBC, whatever, they all need to be in court, you know, or with a Freedom of Information request, you know, saying that we want to see them, because the only response at this point is to have more eyeballs on them before Carlson comes out with his, you know, highly edited bullshit counter history for all of this. But his willingness to sell out his country, his willingness to sell out the Congress
so quickly.
It's so quickly. It is. And again, it's not it's the proper response is not to roll your eyes and say, hey, we told you so. It's like, oh, look, this is happening in real time. That this is what he is doing. He is taking steps that will endanger the safety and security of members of Congress in order for him to personally curry favor with a single reporter who was exposed in the last week for being involved in putting out false information and who has trafficked himself baseless conspiracy theories. I mean, F us, you know,
I stand dumbfounded at times at the way just the sheer ballsiness of it. It's like, okay, what are you going to do about it? And there is this moment where everyone is just so floored, where they're like, wait a minute, oh, time out. You did what? how do you do that? How do you do that with a straight face? How do you say that of all the reporters who are covering January 6th, and he's not a reporter, by the way, in my view. He's a hack.
He's a
mouthpiece for Putin, and he's full of shit 90% of the time, and the other 10% of the time, he's you know, infectious shit. But the reality of it is, he's given this kind of access to me is problematic on a number of levels. So it then begs the question, sort of bringing the scope out a little bit further. If this is the way the party is functioning, the leadership of the party is functioning, if the new mouthpiece of the party is not McCarthy, but Marjorie Taylor Greene, who's been all over the news the last 2 weeks, she's been the spokesperson saying the most since McCarthy's become speaker about pretty much everything, right? From international affairs to domestic concerns here at home. You have the not so subtle yet underwhelming announcement by Nikki Haley that she's running for president. Our friend Tom Nichols put out a piece that said the pointless Nikki Haley campaign, in which he asked the question, why did she bother? So I'll ask you, why did she bother?
I think you can probably get much bigger speaking fees after being a candidate for president than before that. Okay, I know that's cynical, but you know, it's not
far off the mark, my friend.
well, she certainly is an indication of, you know, how far opportunism is willing to go, even being willing to break with Donald Trump. I mean, the reality is that I don't know what, I'm sorry to get into this sort of thing, but, you know, which lane she's in here. The MAGA folks are, you know, think that she has betrayed the Orange God King. She's not going to be the anti-Trump candidate. Her unwillingness to identify any area of disagreement with Donald Trump tells you, you know, a certain level of unseriousness. There is one thing that's interesting about her candidacy, which is that if she wanted to, she really could lead on the issue that we discussed earlier. She's taken a very strong position on support of Ukraine.
Yeah.
And this would be in her wheelhouse. She could articulate that position, but at some point she would also have to explain that in fact, it's very different than the position that Donald Trump is taking. But she's not willing to do that.
Yeah.
She's not willing to lead and say, this is what I believe. I disagree with what Donald Trump says. If you're not willing to do that, how the hell do you think you're going to beat him for the nomination?
Charlie, dude, she was given the opportunity not once, mm-hmm. not twice, but three times by Hannity when she was on the show. Where do you differ with President Trump?
Yep.
And in that moment, she could have said, well, yeah, a lot of domestic policies we align, but on Ukraine, to your exact point, Charlie, she could have declared independence. She could have declared, she could have created a lane
right.
that would have afforded her a lot more runway than she had up to that moment. And she whiffed. Following her, another possible entrant into the campaign, Senator Tim Scott, also from the great state of South Carolina, again, asked about Donald Trump. His response was, oh, I can't think of anything where I disagree with Donald Trump. I am just so happy he was president. Really? Really? That's your go-to?
And you're running.
You want to be the president and you can't even contextualize your opposition to one of the main opponents that you're going to run into. You can't distinguish yourself. So if you're running Nikki and Tim and you can't see, there's no difference between you and Trump, then why should we vote for you?
Well, you know, I'm flashing back now.
I mean, the chairman in me kind of looks at it that way, but what do I know, right? Go ahead.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, so remember that picture from 2016 of the future of the Republican Party? And there's Nikki Haley standing next to Tim Scott, standing next to Marco Rubio. And we're all going, that's the future of the Republican Party. And later tonight, I'm going to be sitting down with Paul Ryan. I'm old enough to remember when Paul Ryan was the future of the Republican Party. And what you realize is that after 6 or 7 years, how not only has the party been completely transformed, but all of these people who at one point were the future of the party have been completely changed and diminished so dramatically.
That's the important word, diminished. I cannot agree with
you. They didn't change now. Trump. Trump transformed everything.
Absolutely. And so then you have another entrant into the foray here, the anti-woke GOP entrepreneur, Vivek Ramaswamy, who announced his intentions, his 2024 presidential bid. Now, he's known as a healthcare and tech sector kind of entrepreneur, but mostly known for his criticism of so-called woke culture and woke capitalism. But no one knows who he is. So
no one knows who he is.
I'm so okay. There's that.
Yeah, that strikes me as a disadvantage when you want to run for president, is that no one knows who you are. And most people hearing this are going to go, and I probably shouldn't bother finding out. So,
right.
I mean, I realize life is short.
I'm better off not knowing.
You know how bad it is if it's not worth a Google search. You know,
This is very true. This is very true. So, you know, so you've got this sort of bubbling cauldron of presidential wannabes, all kind of looking to get in the pool. Some have gotten in. Donald Trump is sitting there going, okay, y'all, everybody in the pool. Does that dynamic still hold true that the more people get into this race, regardless of their stature, unless one of them is actually able to sort of cleave off a direct narrative with Trump. Trump is pretty much in the catbird seat right now. I think a number of folks have even said that recently.
I think so. Let me give you the counter argument, which I don't believe.
Okay.
As starting off, is that the more candidates that come out and that present a compelling and attractive vision of what post-Trump Republicanism can be, will create a mood for people to turn the page. People will say, you know, this is good. It's nice to walk out into the sunshine without, you know, carrying this guy on my head every day. But you know, as you listen to Nikki Haley or Tim Scott, you get a completely different vision. It does feel as if we've turned the page. People are in the mood to turn the page. People
right.
are in the mood not to have more 80-year-olds, etc. So maybe you create that environment. I wish that was true, but that's just wish casting on my part. You're right. The more candidates that are in the race, the better for Trump, because whatever happens, whatever anybody says, he's got a pretty iron lock on 30-40% of that electorate. If these primaries are winner take all, as they are in many states, all he needs is to win a plurality of the votes.
Yes.
70% of Republicans can vote against him, as they did back in 2016, that big majority, and he'll still just rack up all of the delegates. And then you know what happens, Michael? All the lemmings fall into line again.
Yes,
the people who are out there, all the anti-Trumpers will say, well, actually,
I support the nominee of our party because
exactly,
it's important exactly. that we take the White House back in 2024.
That's right. That's
bitch.
Right. Yeah, that's going to be
so,
it.
Give me this bitch yeah. ass answer.
Yep,
I'm
yep,
so,
yep, yep.
I'm giving zero F's on that point in this campaign. Zero. I am like so ready for that lame ass crappy answer because the nominee of your party tried to overthrow the government, has advocated for tearing up the Constitution. And don't give me this bitch ass answer that, oh, well, I support the nominee of my party because, you know, he's a Republican. Okay, that's not Republicanism. And if that's what Republicanism is, then you need to tell the country that we are fully anti-democratic. But y'all still pretend as much as you want. I can't do it, Charlie. I can't. And
yeah,
you know, every
yeah.
day people are like, why are you still in the party? Why are you still? I'm like, yeah.
well, well,
because
you want to update that answer?
Yeah. Oh, Charlie, do you have a couch I can lie down on? It was give me a beer, give me one of those wonderful Wisconsin ales, and I will lie down. And oh my God, it's so bad, man! It is so bad. What do we do, Charlie? I mean, you left, right? You're out.
Well, I was never. I'm
an independent. You were always
yeah.
an independent.
Well,
but
I was a line, but I can't be anymore. I will tell you that it's sort of an interesting phenomenon that I'm starting to hear from people I haven't heard from for years, you know, from Republican circles who are talking about some latest craziness, you know, when the alligator came to eat them, which always shocks them. And all the conversations go like, oh, my God, these people are crazy. This is terrible. And because I am who I am, I always respond by saying, if only you'd been warned
right.
For all of this. But it always comes down to, well, what can we do about this? And I say, well, okay, didn't we have this conversation back in 2016? What you needed to do about all of this? But that's kind of old. And now you are shocked to find out that you're running buck naked down the street and this giant crocodile that you were absolutely convinced would never come after you is racing after your ass. I mean, really?
Oh, yes, I've had those conversations. Yeah. And I just gotta look at folks and I'm like, okay, whatever. You know, here's the other part of the conversation that I'm giving zero F's for now. So, and this happened recently at an event here in Washington. I was at this past weekend, and this well-known national Republican comes up to me and starts the bullshit of, oh yeah, there's a former Republican, didn't want to say Rhino because if that had been the words mm-hmm. chosen, there would have been blows thrown. But that word sends me off every time, particularly coming from the people who are the rhinos. But
right.
But anyway, this whole narrative that guys like me and you, who stay true to fundamental conservative ideas and principles around the role of government, rights of individuals, the freedom of the nation, our role in the world, et cetera, that somehow we're the outliers. Yeah. That somehow we became less Republican, less conservative. And I got pretty excited and heated to the point where one of the guests standing next to me said, okay, Michael, we get it. I threw my hand up. I'm like, nah, I'm tired of this shit. And people were like, okay, someone get him a drink and move her somewhere else. I'm just tired of this notion that we're wrong here, that somehow this lack of an embrace of Trump and that bullshit has set us outside of those fundamentals.
And that's the only thing that matters, right? I mean, that's it. I mean, it doesn't matter. They probably changed their minds on a whole bunch of different issues, including, you know, fair trade and internationalism, right, et cetera, and the Constitution. That's okay. But as long as you have the fixed point of being loyal to Donald Trump, then you're okay. But I think this is a story, Michael, they have to tell themselves. Because I think that our existence is a real, it's a challenge, right? It's embarrassing.
And that's why I stay in.
Yeah, yeah.
That's why I stay in the party, because it pisses them off.
So do you go to their potluck dinners? Do you show up at their event? What do you mean to be in the party, Michael? You want to hang out with those people? You want to go to the Lincoln Reagan Day dinner next year?
I'm that kind of guy. Yeah, I'll show up even when if I'm not invited. I'll show up, and I'm that guy, because I just want to rub. I want to hold the mirror up to them, Charlie, and say, look how Dorian Gray you look right now. This is what you really look like. But anyway, I don't want to think you making an exit point. I mean, I think that's their comfort zone. They go there. They goad us. And I look at it as much more of an offensive tactic. In other words, I'll come at Charlie and put him on the defensive about what I'm doing, right? My bad behavior, my embrace of Trumpism, MAGAism, Marjorie Taylor Greene and all of that, my excuse making for all of that. I'll put him on the defensive, so I therefore don't have to explain it. And I cut that shit off now. I'm like, you know what? No, we're not even going to have that conversation, bitch, because that's not how this rolls. You know the reality. I've been in this party since 1976. Your ass just showed up and you're wrong. And so then they don't know what to do with that. Then they're like, oh, you're getting heated. I'm like, yeah, for a good reason. And I think more of us need to do that. Am I mistaken there? Or because I think we've been rather placid in the main. People just walked away and kind of threw their hands up.
Well, that's an interesting question. It's not so much placid as in, you know, I think these conversations became more and more difficult, and then people started avoiding them.
Yeah.
You know, if you've known somebody for 20 or 30 years and suddenly you realize that there's that one conversation, and if you have that, that's it for you guys. You're going to end your friendship. This is also why people go along with all of this stuff. I mean, you know, there's a lot of it is grifting. A lot of it is, you know, ideological rationalization. And part of it is just like, these are the people I hang with. And if I have to say this in order to hang with these people, I'm going to do that. Whereas what you're describing is the willingness to say, you and I might have been friends for 20 years, but I am not taking that bullshit. And, you know, and the moment you'd say that, in their eyes, you'll recognize that little voice of conscience saying, yeah, I really have fucked up here. I've gone along with all of this stuff. And they don't want to have that.
They don't want to have it.
They do not want to be called out in that particular way, which is why among the anti-Trumpers, they hate us so intensely.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's like, as long as we exist, it's a sort of not so silent commentary on what they've done to themselves.
So before I let you get out of here, I want to bring it a little closer to home, because your backyard is always interesting. and it is interesting once again, as this week, the April 4th primary for judicial race, in Wisconsin has been set. Janet, I can't say her last name.
Protasewicz.
Protasewicz, who is a liberal Milwaukee circuit court judge, is on the ballot up against Daniel Kelly, a conservative former Supreme Court justice. And the this thing is, it sounds like it's going to be one for the ages. Get us up to speed on the dynamics of this race.
Okay.
It's a proxy for a lot of shit going on nationally, where you see the parties playing a real role, a bigger, I think,
huge,
unfortunately, a role in a judicial race, which we can get into. But give us your take on the landscape for this race.
No, there's no question about it. I mean, there's been a lot of national coverage of how this race for the swing seat on the Wisconsin State Supreme Court may be the most important election of 2023. Normally, that sort of thing is hype. This one's not. Everything's on the line, control of the court, whether it's abortion, whether it's gerrymandering, whether it is, frankly, democracy, whether or not this court might put its thumb on the scale in the 2024 presidential election, which is one of the reasons why this has gotten such a national profile. I mean, for the first time, I mean, I've been covering these things and being involved in these things for 40 years.
Right.
Never seen anything like this in terms of the intensity, but also the national attention and the way the national Democrats have recognized how important this is. And I think they have a certain amount of momentum. This would be the first time in decades that liberals, progressives would have a majority on the 7-member Supreme Court.
Wow.
So it's a very, very big deal. These are supposedly nonpartisan elections, but nobody has making any pretense that it's anything other than a partisan slugfest. It is unfortunate. They're all just running as straight off partisans saying how they're going to rule. And I'm sorry if people want to nitpick about, I mean, so much for the independent judiciary. But
that's what I have a problem with.
It is. And I agree with you. I mean, this is for people who actually are concerned about the judiciary being independent. No, this is not playing out that way. The conservatives were very divided in this campaign, which is also very, very unusual. The left was very united in this campaign, which is unusual. The Democrats got the conservative they wanted. Mm-hmm. Dan Kelly is a much weaker candidate than the candidate that he beat in the primary. He's been a Supreme Court justice before. Supreme Court justices are never defeated for election in Wisconsin, very, very rarely. He lost in 2020. He got walloped. So he's already a loser on the ballot. Right. But he's probably going to be able to bring in $20 million in outside dark money into the race. So it's going to be very intense. And it's going to be interesting to see what the turnout's going to be in April.
How do you handicap on that point? How do you handicap the turnout? Do you think that this is going to it's a judicial race. So you think it's going to excite people to the point where the Democrats are organized and pull their numbers, or, you know, the sleepy sort of, well, he's, you know, this is nothing more than Trump in a judge's robe, and therefore people won't accept him, and he winds up getting elected anyway.
We're a closely divided state. That's always the case. But there's nothing sleepy about this race. The Democrats here appear, you know, very, very engaged. Turnout was huge for the nonpartisan primary, set all kinds of records. The two progressives on the ballot, there were four candidates on the ballot, two conservative, two progressive. The two progressives between them got 54% of the vote. Now, that's not necessarily predictive, but it's an indication of who was more motivated to turn out and vote.
Right.
And Dan Kelly also just has a hell of a lot of baggage. Just one little thing. Just a few days before the primary, we learned that he'd actually been paid. This guy wants to be a state Supreme Court justice, had been paid $120,000 by the state Republican Party for his work on, quote unquote, election integrity, including very extensive involvement in the so-called fake elector plan.
Oh, geez.
He was giving advice to the fake electors. From my point of view, this makes him uniquely disqualified.
That's not even a consideration there for him.
But also the abortion issue is going to really drive interest and turnout in this race, because here it is a very stark binary choice in Wisconsin.
Yeah, and I heard Janet speaking on that. And I was unnerved by it, not because of the position, but because you're sort of telegraphing how you were going to rule on these types of cases. And I just have a real problem with that fundamentally. All right, Charlie, I've kept you a long time, but I do want to give everyone an update on what's happening at the Bulwark. You guys do incredible work. I highly recommend, my friends who listen to this podcast, check out the work that you guys put out every day. I am a subscriber, so that's how committed I am to the work you're doing. What's the latest? What are you guys working on right now?
Well, we are continuing to try to stand athwart history and saying you can't be serious. We have a number of live events coming up. We're going to be one of the sponsors of the Principals First Conference in Washington, D.C., March 3rd through 5th. We're going to be doing a live podcast there, and we'll be hosting the happy hour. I'm doing a one-on-one with John Bolton, which should be
somewhat
interesting. I think we have some things to talk about. And beyond that, we continue to put out the daily podcasts, the daily newsletters, and we're just trying to keep on keeping on and reminding everybody that you're not the crazy ones.
Thank you. Of all the things that you've said in this conversation, that is the most important.
I think so.
Folks, we are not the crazy ones. Charlie Sykes, I have mad respect for this brother. He's not just a good journalist, but really appreciate his stand for our country and the democracy and advocating for normal people.
Thank you.
Doing good stuff. Follow him certainly on Twitter at Sykes Charlie. Catch his work at the Bulwark, and certainly the Bulwark podcast. And he is a colleague and friend, of course, as a MSNBC contributor, along with myself. Charlie Sykes, it's always a pleasure, buddy, when I get the chance to sit down with you. And I love coming on your podcast as well.
And we'll get you back soon.
I appreciate that opportunity as well.
All right. Thanks so much.
All righty, my friend. That does it for our conversation this time, folks. Remember, I love it when you do the download thing. It makes me feel all yummy inside. Check us out on Apple Podcasts. Follow me on Twitter at Michael Steele. Follow the podcast at Steele_podcast. Until next time, be safe, be well, and remember, you're not the crazy one.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or JeffWeilerColumbusAutoMall.com.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.